The Chinese Academy of Sciences should provide English-speaking spokespeople, scientists who can explain their important work as it comes out. And there's a lot of good work coming out of China. We do have a well-written article posted at phys.org by Li Wan from the Academy. Reading from that article, quote, "During the development of a strong El Niño in 2023, warm anomalies are expected to predominantly affect the tropical central eastern Pacific, the Eurasian continent, and Alaska. However, in the following year, 2024, warm anomalies are likely to encompass the entire continents, significantly increasing the chance of land-based heat waves, droughts, and wildfires." According to Professor Zheng Fei, author of the study, in addition to the surge in surface temperatures, the strong El Niño in 2023-24 is predicted to trigger a cascade of climate crises, end quote. These include marine heat wave intensification, ocean deoxygenation, ocean diversity reduction, damages of marine ecosystems, sea level rise, and crop yields reduction. Furthermore, China may face multiple climate anomalies during this period. For instance, the suppressed winter monsoon in 2023 may lead to elevated winter temperatures in most regions of China and could also increase the probability of air pollution. In 2024, northern China may experience drought in the spring, while southern regions are most likely to face the risk of extreme rainfall and flooding during the summer. So that is a quote from Li Wan covering the scientific paper, "Record-Breaking Global Temperature and Crises with Strong El Niño in 2023-2024. Find out more with links in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Remember, a series of posts from former NASA head scientist James Hansen warned global warming is accelerating. That was posted September 14th at the Columbia University website. Paul Beckwith covers that Hansen post on his YouTube channel with the title, "Acceleration of Global Temperature Rise and Climate Mayhem Expected Over the Next Year." So let's get to some harsh lessons in this new wave of climate change. From it, we must learn some things, and first, global warming does not go up steadily, as shown in too many graphs. It rises in steps, going further upward fairly quickly during a strong El Niño. Then it may appear to stabilize, or even decline in temperature a little bit for a couple of years, but it never goes anywhere back down close to the heat levels before the big step. That happened after the very strong El Niño year in 1997 and 98. The warming continued near the high levels set that year, but not by as much. It was a mistake to call that period, going at least until 2009, a hiatus. The rate of increase slowed, but warming did not stop. After the year 2000, as many countries industrialized and added fossil-driven infrastructure, including car culture and air travel in China and India and many more countries, humans released huge amounts of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Emissions were much higher than even in the 1990s. Why didn't Earth respond with more heating? We now know from many scientific studies during recent decades, the extra energy reflected back to Earth by those emissions was absorbed into the ocean rather than overheating the land. The ability of the ocean to absorb excess energy and carbon is well known, and yet it's not well known. In a recent work, a group of scientists, including optimist Michael Mann and the less optimistic Kevin Trenberth, deduced that if fossil fuel emissions stopped today, the world would not keep warming due to the feedback effects like permafrost, for example. The oceans have the power to rebalance Earth's temperature regime at whatever level of warming exists when the fossil burning ends. The seas could even capture new carbon from feedbacks like thawing permafrost, these scientists say. It's almost like a pardon for our industrial sins, although really the result is a long delay in warming, postponing all that heat to later centuries. The heat captured by the seas and mixed down would eventually return to warm a future Earth, perhaps a millennia later. Discussing that paper with Mann and his colleagues in our interview, Kevin Trenberth discounted the value of this mechanism as a savior, saying we are not ending fossil fuels, but in fact increasing them. So it is just an intellectual argument for now. Climate may reach a new resting point of relative stabilization with a gradual warming after that. Perhaps humans and other species could adapt if we survive that long through the wrenching rate of climate change. While all the media and attention goes to the great judgment of La Niña or El Niño in the Pacific Ocean, Chinese scientists say the Pacific is not the place to look for climate determination. The decider is the Atlantic, and the other end of the great conveyor belt current, the Southern Ocean. The tipping point that can cascade into multiple triggers is the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, known as AMOC. That will determine the big change, they say. Many times, even during the last million years, overturning in the North Atlantic has shifted between two states. AMOC has a positive or strong phase and a negative or weak phase. During the strong phase, huge volumes of water flow from the tropics towards Greenland. There, with the change in their salt content and getting cooler, they sink toward the bottom to begin a long journey back towards Antarctica. That is part of the Great Conveyor Belt. This civilization developed during a strong phase of AMOC, but now that is weakening. Several scientists on Radio EcoShock, including Suzanne Ditlevsen, Johannes Lohmann, and Levka Caesar, document the weakening in the North Atlantic Ocean circulation system. But here is something strange I don't understand yet. The impact of AMOC shifting to a weak phase now appears to have changed. In all earlier ages, a weakening AMOC announces and leads to a cold period, like the one called the Younger Dryas. Now, maybe due to changes in Earth energy imbalance, a weakening AMOC adds to more global heating. I have to find out why. In his series of Radio EcoShock interviews in fall 2022, Kevin Trenberth also told us the El Niño cycle has been overwhelmed by increased greenhouse gases as the major driver of climate change on this planet. So El Niño and La Niña may become the handy hook for news stories that obscure the real causes and our role in them. But we have to look elsewhere to explain the sudden rash of heat waves all over the world in 2023. We do know Earth's oceans were in a decade-long period of mixing. Heat from the surface was mixed into a layer further down. Earth's energy imbalance, as measured at the top of the atmosphere, was hidden by the sea. But that oscillation period ended. The ocean began to release more of the heat. Look up the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. That 20 to 30-year cycle is affecting the way new heat appears. The release of stored sea heat during the Pacific Decadal Oscillation is accelerated by an El Niño condition. El Niño is marked by hotter surface temperatures in the Pacific, releasing so much heat that weather around the world is affected. As Hansen and others like Kevin Trenberth explained, measurements of past El Niño events show the largest effect is delayed until the second year. For us now, that would be 2024, as the Chinese Academy paper also predicts. But something else is happening at the same time. Because even at the very start of this El Niño, Earth shattered every major heat record in both hemispheres, regardless of the season, summer or winter. That is a novel climate change developing not in the second year as expected, but immediately. Most scientists that I follow are struggling to find out why. A small group of scientists and researchers claim the early heat rise is due mainly to changes in aerosols. People like James Hansen and EcoShock guest Leon Simons point to a large reduction in sulfur particles in the atmosphere following new ship pollution regulations in 2020. That did happen, and no doubt it has some heating power. Others are looking at the missing mirror at the bottom of the Earth. Sea ice around Antarctica practically disappeared, leaving a dark, heat-absorbing ocean surface instead of the reflective white ice. But that alone doesn't seem enough energy change to power record heat as we experienced in 2023. There is a scramble to assess all the pieces. Was a tipping point crossed? That could have happened even a few years ago, and just it's coming into sight and experience now. Answers seem important, as life as we know it may hang in the balance. Here is a second lesson, and I will call it patchy warming. Figures used for global mean temperature rise over the pre-industrial times are misleading when assessing the risk and reality where you live. The globe does not warm as one planet. Warming is patchy. The United States is warming faster than average. The Arctic is warming 4 times faster than average. Here is a few minutes from an excellent piece from PBS Terra, posted on YouTube in April 2023.
But no one lives in an average.
Every continent in the world is warming, but the rate of change of that warm can differ from place to place.
So where is warming fastest and where is warming the slowest? There are two big picture factors at play: latitude and oceans. First, high latitudes in the far north are warming fastest, largely because of sea ice. As temperatures rise, sea ice melts, exposing dark water that absorbs more solar radiation, which causes more warming, and the cycle continues. Now, the cycle won't continue forever. Once enough sea ice has melted, this Arctic amplification will slow down, and the Arctic will warm at a rate more similar to the rest of the globe. But for now, if you're farther north, you're probably warming fast. Second, water reflects more of the sun's energy than land does, and it has a far higher heat capacity. So it takes a lot more energy to raise ocean temperatures than land temperatures. That means our large continents are warming faster than the oceans. And guess what? That's where humans live. Put this together and you get this generalization. Large land masses in the north are warming fastest. Most of the Earth's land masses are in the mid-latitudes and northern hemisphere, so those regions are warming faster than southern regions. But which continents are warming the fastest? Europe is the fastest warming continent at 0.47 degrees Celsius of warming per decade since 1980, and Asia comes in close second. Globally, there are some unusual hotspots as well. A mysterious pocket off the coast of Uruguay and Argentina has warmed twice as fast as the global average, causing algae blooms and mass die-offs of marine species. There also seems to be a similar hotspot in the North Atlantic along the coast of Delaware to Maine. These hotspots seem to be largely driven by shifting ocean currents that bring warmer water to unlikely places. Interestingly, some places are warming slower for unexpected reasons. Parts of Antarctica have slowed warming in part because of the ozone hole, and India is warming less than its surroundings because of severe pollution keeping out solar radiation. And that cool spot in the Arctic? That's caused likely by Greenland's melting ice. So that brings us back to the U.S. Researchers at the University of Massachusetts found that the lower 48 is expected to reach 2 degrees of warming 10 to 20 years before the globe as a whole. From previous episodes, we know that the western U.S. is getting drier. And it turns out precipitation plays a big role in which regions are warming. Vegetation, trees, and moisture can help mitigate warming, while drought can make it worse.
But we are seeing parts of the West and the Northern Tier warming faster than the rest of the country. And a lot of the driver for this is that drought periods in the West are becoming more entrenched. And as regions that are dry become more dry, that means there's less moisture in the soil. And so you'll actually have higher temperatures during the day. We're talking parts of the interior Rockies, portions of, you know, Oregon, California, as well as parts of the northern tier, Minnesota, Montana.
We also know that the Northeast is warming faster than the U.S. average and is expected to reach 3 degrees Celsius of warming when the globe as a whole reaches 2.
Higher latitudes are warming faster. winter is the fastest warming season for the Northern Hemisphere, certainly for the U.S.
This means extreme winter warming all the way from Montana to Maine. One reason for this is that snowpack is melting earlier in the season. Fewer days of snow cover means more sunlight that absorbs into the ground, warming the region.
That was from PBS Terra. The program Weathered is hosted by weather expert Maya May and produced by Balance Media. Get that YouTube link in my blog at ecoshock.org. Another aspect of using global mean temperature, like 1.5 degrees C or 2 degrees over pre-industrial, is very misleading. Land will warm up much more than the sea. It takes unimaginable amounts of energy to heat the vast sea even a little. Land heats up relatively quickly, sometimes in a few days. Oceans cover more than 70% of the planet. If the ocean heats up, say, 1 degree, land temperatures might go up 2 degrees C or more in some places, yielding a global average, sure, of 1.5 degrees C heating. In reality, the heat you and I experience will be much more than the small-sounding 1.5 degrees C or 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. An overview from a large mind might help. Last June, videographer Nick Jen interviewed Dr. David King. He was former chief scientist for the United Kingdom. This 13-minute condensed version, released by Nick Jen on YouTube, brings an overview of where we are and what we could do. There is a longer version for Jen's supporters.
This 10-minute edit is a summary version, edited from the full interview. The full episode is available for YouTube and Patreon members, so this edited version captures key elements of the discussion. In this Climate Gen episode, I speak with former UK chief scientist and chair of the Climate Crisis Advisory Group, Sir David King. Sir David explains what is going on with the Antarctic sea ice and how this connects to the wider global climate system. We also discuss the differences between Arctic and Antarctic sea ice and how the North Pole is at risk of releasing vast quantities of methane that could send global temperatures soaring. All of this inevitably leads to the question of action to reduce risk and steer humanity back onto a survivable pathway. Sir David highlights the dangers of what we are all being offered by the incoming COP28 presidency. The next episode of Climate Gen is recorded with former President Obama advisor and National Security Director Dr. Alice Hill as we discuss the retreat of the insurance industry in the US as climate change proves too risky for business. Thanks for listening. David, it's good to see you again. Thank you very much for taking the time. I just wanted to start by asking you about the data coming out of Antarctica regarding the sea ice lows, because a lot of people are very worried. Can you talk about how you interpret what you're seeing?
The first thing is that the data shows that the sea ice around Antarctica appears to be suddenly retreating. And I'm just talking about this year and the last few months of last year. The sea ice has retreated about 1.9 million square kilometers compared with the norm at this time of the year. So I'm talking about the end of May, when the figure would normally be 9 million square kilometers, and it's now down to 7.2 million square kilometers. That's the biggest drop ever observed. And it means that during the summer months, when it's normally 3 million square kilometers, it is now down to less than one, or just over one. So it's a very severe signal that in the summer months, there will be much less sea ice protecting the ice on land around Antarctica.
Okay. And it's this buttressing effect where the sea ice almost acts as a blocker to stop those land ice sheets sliding into the sea. Can you just give a quick overview of how that's different to how we view sea ice in the Arctic?
Of course, the North Pole is an ocean surrounded by land. The South Pole is land surrounded by ocean. That's the most important difference. So what we're seeing in the North Pole region is that the ice has retreated from the sea around the North Pole. And what this means is that the warm sea is then raising the temperature of the landmass around. And we're seeing all sorts of absolutely damaging effects in terms of the whole world. So in the North Pole region, we have rising sea levels. When all the ice on Greenland melts, sea levels will have risen by about 7 meters. And I'm talking about the global average sea level rise. Obviously, the map of the world is changed dramatically by that. And equally, the land mass is heated up, and we're already seeing explosive release of methane from the permafrost. Let's go back to the Antarctic. In the Antarctic, because the oceans are warming up, and are warming up rather quickly now, we see that warm water can penetrate between the ice on land. Antarctica is this vast continent. It's penetrating between the land and the ice and creating a slippery layer, which means that the danger is so we get very large chunks of ice coming off the landmass and entering the ocean. So the ice around the South Pole region, around the Antarctica, protects the water around that region in terms of its temperature. So it keeps the temperature cooler. That's the buffer effect you've just referred to.
When you look around the world at the moment and you see things like this new El Nino developing straight off the back of the La Nina, and you see in extreme situations though, the Atlantic being above its normal temperatures and so on, and the Arctic heating away. Is it conceivable, do you think? I know you've got to wait and see, but is it conceivable that we could be sort of crossing some sort of threshold? It seems that everything's going up a notch. We're always slightly notching up. Is it too early to make those kinds of...
I'm afraid it's not too early. So, for example, let's go back up towards the North Pole region, where things are happening much more quickly. We know that we have this wind blowing anticlockwise around the North Pole region, which keeps cold air in the North Pole region and warm air away from it, and that means it keeps us warmer than we would otherwise be. We know that that roughly circular wind is now massively distorted, and it's distorted because if you create warm atmospheric air above this exposed Arctic sea during the polar summer, that warm air is driving the cold air further down, and as you drive the cold air further down in one place, warm air comes up in another. And this is really disturbing the global weather systems dramatically already. All of these extreme weather events we've been observing, you've just mentioned what's happening in New York today, but in 2021, the weather extremes on the West Coast were simply amazing. So, and when I say that, I mean 5 to 10 degrees centigrade above the previous warmest ever observed on record by human beings in that part of the world. So I think it is, I'm afraid, a sign of the times.
If we're not actually tackling the root cause, which we don't seem to be, we're going into, you know, another year of extremely high emissions. How can we honestly look at interventions if we're not actually prepared to reduce our emissions and give up fossil fuels?
You are absolutely right. We are still moving in the wrong direction globally, even after that wonderful agreement in 2015 that we were all going to do everything we could to stay below 1.5 degrees above the pre-industrial level. It's now clear that with this El Nino event that you have just referred to, which is a Pacific Ocean event, with that event coming on so quickly after the La Nina, we know that the climate is going to be suddenly warmer around much of the world. And so all of these effects that we've been seeing over the last 4 or 5 years, these extreme weather events, can only get worse. And I think it is awful to say that emissions in terms of billions of tons of greenhouse gases we're putting into the atmosphere every year are still going up quickly. The carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere going up now at 2 parts per million per annum. And 2 parts per million per annum is higher than ever before. So we're not managing this. If we don't bring down from, we're now well in excess of 40 billion tons of greenhouse gases going into the atmosphere every year. Unless we can bring that down to 10% of that figure within 20 years, let's say, it's very difficult to see how we create a manageable future for humanity.
You mentioned the Paris Agreement, and in a way, that was the year when everyone rejoiced that the world leaders were getting their act together and were going to do something about this, enact the policy that would make structural change. And yet, a year later, Trump was elected and things went sideways and so on and so forth. And now we see protesters quite prepared to be put in jail, really making a noise. There's like a sort of desperation in the action. Are we at a point now where people are waking up to what's really happening, and yet the policymakers are entrenched in a sort of last century view, if you like? We're not ready to snap into this action to get rid of our emissions. And the word I think you used previously was agile, about this need to be agile in our processes. And we seem to lack that agility. Yes.
We lack the agility. We have become bogged down in a dramatically destructive mode of operation. I mean, I think the United Nations has still got to be the critical pathway forward. That's the only body that represents all nations. But if you have a negotiating process in which any country can send as many official negotiators as they like into those annual negotiations, and the average is now 20 per country, that means 4,000 negotiators meeting for 2 weeks. How do you negotiate in that sort of atmosphere? When I was leading from the Foreign Office, the British side of the negotiations, I had explained to the heads of governments that I was working for that we need to have bilateral action. And that's why I visited 96 countries on official visits in the run-up to Paris. Those bilateral negotiations were, for me, the only way of breaking this logjam. Now, the problem is that we are back into the logjam, and all of the promises made in Paris, all of the promises, I mean, there are very few countries that are delivering, have not been adhered to. I was talking to Salim al-Haq yesterday from Bangladesh, and Salim was saying, all of you should come to Bangladesh. You cannot speak to anyone over the age of 12 who won't tell you what the challenges of climate change are. Because in Bangladesh, it's not tomorrow's event. They are losing acreage by the year.
And really, if you take all of what we've just said and you pitch forward to COP28, which is controversially being hosted by the UAE's head of their national oil company, what are your thoughts on those ties and what appears to be a dampening down of ambition to phase out fossil fuels in those terms, as opposed to reducing emissions through carbon capture and storage?
This, of course, is the big worry about COP28. Simply having it in the Middle East, the biggest oil-producing area in the world, it was already a bit of a red flag. And then to have Sultan Al-Jaber, the man you're referring to, run the organization. I've met him. He's charming. He's a lovely guy. You wouldn't mind having an evening in the pub with him. But he believes we will consume more and more oil and gas going forward in time, we globally, and we will capture all of the carbon dioxide, and so we can manage to get to net zero by 2050. So there's a person who's in the presidency who is the nightmare scenario person. Right? Is that scenario that I've just painted, that they'll say, ah, good, get on with it, you guys. More money for the scientists and technologists, and we'll keep producing the oil to pay for it.
Well, thank you very much. It's been great to speak to you. I think we've covered all the bases.
And can I say thank you, Nick? I always enjoy talking to you.
That was the UK's former chief scientist, Sir David King, in conversation with videographer and climate communicator Nick Chen. Find his project at Climate Chen, www.chen.cc. And Chen has two N's. I'm Alex Smith. We are out of time. Please join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
Radio Rewind.